Shrink Wrap Radio number 440, Mindfulness and Self-Compassion as Tools for Shifting Out of Depression, with Dr. Elisha Goldstein.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with return guest Dr. Elisha Goldstein about his new book, Uncovering Happiness: Overcoming Depression with Mindfulness and Self-Compassion. For more information about Dr. Elisha Goldstein, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Elisha Goldstein, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
So great to be here again. Especially with you, David.
Well, thank you, and it's great to have you back on. I'm really pleased to have you on the show again. Our first interview was back in 2008 on mindfulness-based stress reduction, and I think you were kind of just starting to get rolling then, and your career has really been taking off. And so then in 2012, we talked about your book, The Now Effect. And today we're going to discuss your latest book, which I believe just came out, Uncovering Happiness, Overcoming Depression with Mindfulness and Self-Compassion. You have been a busy fellow.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when it's a passion, you really put your mind to it, but it's hard at times, but it's great. It's really rewarding.
Yeah. And am I right that this latest book just came out very recently?
Just came out, yeah. It's just arriving right now. It's hot up the presses. It's already been featured in Good Morning America. It's been featured in the lead story of Parade magazine and many other places like that. It's I think it's really finding the group of people who are really needing it and wanting it and taking it in.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad to hear that you're getting lots of good press, and hopefully this contribution will add to that. Now, something I recall from our previous interviews is that you know something about depression yourself beyond your training as a psychologist, because, in fact, there was a period before you became a psychologist in which your life was going off the rails. And I know you've covered that, and you cover it in your book, but maybe for new listeners, you can take us through some of that background again.
You know, it's interesting. I actually think, like, people like me, there's, you know, the statistic is there's 25 million people in America who struggle with depression, and there's 350 million people worldwide. But that being a very small statistic, only because, the way I see it anyway, because this is something that's so shrouded in shame that many people don't talk about it. They aren't willing to, confess to it. And so I think the numbers are even much larger than that, even though that's a giant number, the number one cause of disability in our corporate culture, being depression. But for me, you know, I think you're talking about a time where, I was in my kind of early to mid 20s. And if I look back depression was really to some degree there for me even earlier on. More around the ages of 6 or 7, around that time, I was like an incredibly angry kid. You know, I was lashing out. Everyone would, I was that willful kid that had his arms crossed and his face in a frown. And then I look back into that time, and there was definitely some of that there. With kids, it comes out as anger and irritability, less as like isolation as much. I mean, that's also there at times, but more with in that way. And then, you know, when I was writing, I'll never forget when I was, so that early 20s, that time, early 20s, mid 20s was the deepest, darkest time. There was periods that were the deepest, darkest time of my life. It's very clear, easy to point out for me that was that, where I was, you know, working hard in the corporate world. I was successful. And because of that, here's like a little mask of depression. Because of that, if you're successful and if there things seem to be going okay, it's even more reason to deny something that's there. And because as long as I'm doing okay in some way, you know, then I don't need to really look at this. But I was abusing my mind.
If you're using money as a measure, for example, sounds like you had a good income, and so that could lead you to believe, well, there's no problem with me.
That's right. And what's a fascinating thing, Dave, is that the, you know, for me, I had never been like the best at anything. And when I found my place in this kind of like sales world, I was selling telecom to businesses, business to business in the corporate world. At first it was just long distance because back then there wasn't really internet as much. I was up there with like the best in this company. And you would think that would be source of just genuine happiness in some way. And that, I think that really kind of tells the story of how money really does not buy happiness. And so I was really lost and confused. And so I was partying quite a bit. One night I found myself in a broken down limousine with a guy that was really just a shadow of himself. And he was a guy that I had seen before in the night scene and, told my friends that really, if you ever catch me with this guy, then, you know that I've kind of hit rock bottom, and I really had. And I had a moment of awakening. I call that the aha moment. That's that now effect. Where I said, I don't have to treat myself this way. I'm worth more than this. So that sense of unworthiness, I was working against that to some degree. That's that shame that's really there. That's part and parcel with feeling depressed. And I picked myself up, and it wasn't such a clean transition so much, but I went away to a retreat center for a month and really challenged everything I knew about life. And that's where I got introduced to this, one of the natural antidepressants that science is finding right now and that we're finding in our lives. That's where I really came in touch with mindfulness and, this idea of intentionally paying attention to what's here, this idea of being aware, with a sense of curiosity. And it's an approach mindset instead of an avoidance mindset, which is what depression, really is. And there began my journey towards recognizing that really what I wanted to do was learn how to help myself and help other people, live a life that was purposeful, meaningful, and genuinely be happy. And what I mean by that is not the passing pleasures that are there, but something that's a little bit deeper, more enduring, no matter the waves that come, there's this sense that there's a sense of confidence internally that I can handle it and things are going to be okay.
You know, one of the things that I'm struck by is that when you were in the corporate world, you were experiencing your own competence and success kind of for the first time, feeling like you were the best in the company, you were really good at something, and that you had a kind of energy and maybe sort of hard charging kind of energy. And it seems to me that that characteristic is still in you, but in a healthier way, that you've channeled that charging horse into this other more healthful direction, both more healthful for you and for those around you.
Yeah, that's in some ways that's this kind of learning mindset that's there that I think is also a key, natural antidepressant that's there, which is this idea of, looking back at my life and saying, hey, what was, rather than kind of flogging myself like, oh, how terrible. I mean, there's certainly an emotional impact, even when I've done a lot of work around kind of reflecting back on that time in my life and, what was happening and being able to look back there. And while, to this day, I still get a tinge as I talk about it, because it was really, quite a painful time to be treating myself like that. But I look back and I say, what really worked for me and what did not work for me there? What kind of drew me into that world, that life? And what was I doing, and what helped lift me out of that? So in other words, I'm kind of looking at it really with fresh eyes. And I'm trying to learn versus kind of rate myself that I was really performing really poorly in life in some way there. And saying, what a, jackass I was in some way, if I could say that on your show.
Yes, you can.
Yeah. And so like reinforcing a sense of shame that's there. Instead, I kind of look at it and, see the wounding that was there and say, what did I learn from that experience? That's the fastest way to not only kind of get back on track, but actually kind of shore up and strengthen what's there. And so that, and also just to be kind of clear. When you look at the neuroscience of it, to have kind of a sense of learning, to have a learning mindset and a sense of curiosity is the one of the most effective ways to create neuroplasticity, to use our minds to change our brains. And so adopting that kind of mindset, and we could talk further about that because it's a really important topic, is key, is one of the keys to creating what I've called an antidepressant brain.
Well, good. That's kind of good news for me, since doing this podcast series forces me in a way to be continually curious. Now, the other two books were very much about mindfulness as well, but this newest book of yours, which is also about mindfulness, but it has a very specific focus on depression. And so what motivated you to tackle the topic of depression?
Well, actually, let me say, I'll talk about all that right now, which is, you know, for the past 7 or 8 years now, I've been teaching about mindfulness and depression. I've been teaching and been very close and in touch with the group of guys that created mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is a wonderful program for helping people not relapse into depression. It's a program that teaches people how to create a mindfulness practice in their life, how to get some distance from their thoughts, and relate to them differently, and even put into action some kind of action plan that helps them in some way. It's a wonderful program. But what I learned through that is that mindfulness on its own, when it comes to depression, is not enough. It's not enough to just cultivate a balanced awareness. And when you've struggled with depression off and on in your life, because the research shows that many people who have been struggling with depression off and on have a very low degree of self-compassion. Self-compassion is the notion of, I'm understanding that I'm suffering right now. There's something in me that's a struggle, whether it's a stressor, or whether I'm just feeling down, or whether I just got some bad news, or whether I'm feeling shame, or I'm worried about something, whether I'm fighting with my kids right now in this moment, or whether I'm worried about my ailing parents. There's something in this moment I'm suffering. I can kind of coin it together, that experience. And then there's this inclination. So rather than flogging myself, which happens oftentimes when we're starting to feel depressed, and being self-critical, I'm inclining to support myself in this way. So that experience of understanding that I'm suffering, with the inclination to want to support myself, is very low. There's a very low degree of that with people who have struggled with depression over time. So with mindfulness, the idea is that what we should do is we should kind of hold this intentional awareness of what's here and be with the experience that's here. And implicitly, what will arise from that is this notion of compassion towards myself. But what I found is that's not necessarily the case. People have struggled with depression off and on over time, sometimes really need scaffolding. In other words, they need skills, to learn skills to shore up, to increase their self-compassion quotient, so that then it can implicitly arise after that. And that's been really helpful. So when I've been leading these classes, I've seen people really drawn to this idea of self-compassion and the skill set of it, and really wanting it, as if there's a hunger for it in some way. And I've seen the transformations from being able to cultivate the sense of being kind towards ourselves in the midst of something that's difficult. So the mindfulness and some self-compassion, you know, those two, as I talk about in Uncovering Happiness, are the kind of the two wings of the bird that allow us to fly. They're the fundamental natural antidepressants that are there. But on their own, there's more. So again, mindfulness on its own, it's not enough. So while you might say in the first book, a mindfulness-based stress reduction workbook, we bring people through the MBSR program, which is just such a popular and amazing program that's out there. And in the Now Effect, again, I'm deepening people's experience into mindfulness in an easier, kind of digestible way. And then also, you'll notice there's a section in there called Priming Your Mind for Good. I'm already starting to weave in this kind of positive psychology notion of like, well, maybe we also need to encourage what's good here. Let's start to do that. And in this book, I bring that to a whole different level. which I'm really kind of diving down into the science and practice of, yes, there's mindfulness. We need to be aware of our, and we'll talk about this, the depressive loop and the conditioning that's there and why depression is like a trauma, how to reverse the bad habits that fuel that depression loop, how to fundamentally become aware of mindfulness and what the value and practice of that is, self-compassion. But then there's these other elements that are also equally as important, if not entry points, even more so than mindfulness and self-compassion when it comes to depression, like purpose, play, and developing a sense of mastery or confidence that comes through having a learning mindset. Those are all key natural antidepressants in the science.
Yeah, and we're going to get into those as we go along. So my original question was what motivated you to tackle the topic of depression? Well, what I partly get from what you've said, especially in the first part, it sounds like it was almost coming to you as you were working with people that maybe depression was the thing that kept coming up.
Yeah.
Would that be right?
I'm a psychologist and a mindfulness teacher. That was just in some ways, it was a really natural fit that the main program that was out there, aside from mindfulness-based stress reduction, was a program around mindfulness and depression. And in my whole, I have depression off and on, as many people do, all throughout our families. And so it wasn't something in my personal life or within my family that's so foreign. And it felt really good getting a group of people inside of a room who all shared to some degree a common thread in their background. And the value of that is, you know, even in just being a therapist, the value of that is healing on its own, because of depression being such a experience of feeling so alone, like I'm the only one, everyone's mm-hmm. doing better than me type of idea. But for people to mm-hmm. come together in the group, and I've heard this over and over and over again, to say, like, God, you know, just being in this group is powerful, because no one ever talks about this stuff in public. And the shame kind of melts away. And so I was really drawn to it. I think that's I was really drawn to it because there's something really powerful and it's very touching and meaningful in that work and working with mindfulness and depression.
Yeah, you mentioned family dynamics, and I also have that thread running through my family and through my own life. So this topic is of personal interest as well. Now, what audience did you have in mind as you were writing this book?
That's a really good question. The audience I have are the people that were feeling that have experienced some form of depression in the past, and that could be major depression. That could be dysthymia, that low grade kind of experience of ongoing discontent with life. That's there. Some people who identify as anxious, maybe, but how the anxiety kind of gets a hold of them and really bums them out in mm-hmm. life, because they feel like, am I ever going to get a hold of this? Like, anxiety is so mm-hmm. overlaps with some kind of depressive experiences. People that have felt overwhelmed in life. Again, the word depression is such a, for some people, is very taboo a word. And so for people who have felt overwhelmed in life and felt like, you know, am I ever going to get out from under this overwhelm? I would describe that also as some form of feeling depressed. So there's a whole range. You know, I mentioned in the introduction that depression has, you know, many faces. And, you know, you can kind of describe it in the science as, you know, everywhere from the way pneumonia attacks the lungs, you know, depression attacks the brain, you know, in that way, to kind of people who have allergies, where it's more of kind of a lighter ongoing, kind of off and on ongoing type of experience, but still frustrating and making you feel down nonetheless. So that whole range.
You mentioned the pneumonia example of pneumonia attacking the lungs and depression attacking the brain. And I seem to recall reading that chronic depression actually can physically affect the brain in a way that can be seen. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. I mean, I think in this, my own experience with this has been to kind of look towards the neuroscience to some degree and say, what do we know about a brain that's been depressed over time, or off and on over time? What do we know about a brain that's actively depressed? And what I found was some very interesting findings. which was in a brain that's been actively depressed off and on over time, you can see some real differences in the brain. For example, the prefrontal cortex, which you know, but many of the listeners, this might be revealing to some degree, or you might already know this, is involved with, it's called executive function. It's what helps us make our short-term decisions along with our long-term goals. It's involved with impulse control, all this stuff, perspective. And so that area of the brain in some brains is even kind of shrunken a little bit. When in a depressed brain, you'll see a lot of activity in the right prefrontal region. That's involved with kind of avoiding things in life. And that's also involved in, so this isn't what people get confused and they think I'm talking about right brain, left brain. I'm not talking about right brain, left brain. I'm saying right prefrontal area. So avoiding things in life also lights up when we're feeling negative emotions. The left side of the brain lights up when we're approaching things and also is involved with positive emotions, has been associated with resiliency. So what that, those are a couple of differences. The amygdala, which some people have kind of called the fear circuit, it's really the kind of the circuit that first takes in our senses and decides, like, is it safe or unsafe, and then decides to disseminate more activity throughout the rest of the brain if it is inflamed, if not actually enlarged in a depressed brain. And so we're looking at, like, what's the difference here? So can we look to the brain to say what things can help us reduce activity in the amygdala, create a left prefrontal shift, also in the hippocampus, the part of the brain just right kind of behind the amygdala, is involved with learning, memory, putting things in context in life, meaning like when we're depressed, you can see people will be crying just all over the place. There's no sense of, the brain doesn't have a sense of context of where, as it would in other times in life, where it's appropriate to do that or not. And one thing that we know is that when we look at a brain that's gone through PTSD or gone through chronic stress over time, you see highly similar, a lot of similarities between those two brains. You see that same shrunken hippocampus, enlarged amygdala. You see, or overactive anyway, you see a lot of right prefrontal shifting going on in the prefrontal area. So that tells me just neurobiologically, depression is a trauma to the brain. And so when we look at it that way, just like when we get bit by a dog, the trauma of that, and when, you know, you can get bit by a Doberman and then a Chihuahua curls around the corner, you know, the next day on a leash and your body flinches. Depression does the same thing. It creates this this conditioned looping of thoughts, emotions, sensations, and behaviors that all get strongly interconnected together. So all you need is a kind of neural firing that ignites one of these things in the loop, and the rest of it just kind of fires up together, kind of like a circle that has gasoline around it, and you light, you know, one end of it, and the rest of it kind of lights up immediately. Same type of idea there with that depressive loop. And so you know, so you can wake up one morning and just feel tired. You get a bad night's sleep, or maybe have kind of a string of kind of negative thoughts that happen, you know, in your mind, or maybe your body's, or maybe you're feeling kind of sad one day because grief is starting to arise again, or maybe you ate a whole bag of potato chips or anything like that. But any of those that are associated with that depression loop from the past will ignite the rest of it, and all of a sudden we'll just experience the sense of just being depressed, and we'll say, where did this come from? How did I get, you know, to this place? Just like snap my fingers, now I'm kind of depressed. Where did this come from? Meanwhile, there's been these little signs along the way that have been there, that have been saying, like, that have been kind of lighting up to say, this is coming right now. And so we all have our personal depressive loops that are there. And helping to identify those, the different elements of them, helps us get a little space, ignites a little bit of mindfulness, helps us get a little space from there where we can get perspective, break that looping when it's happening, the conditioned reaction, and be able to get some perspective on what might be the most adaptive thing to do in that moment.
Yeah, you know, I like that idea of the loop. Well, I don't like the idea. I don't like the phenomenon, but the concept certainly is familiar to me personally. And also, I think I've thought of it more in conjunction with worrying, but I don't know how much separation there really is between worrying and depression. I think there's probably a lot of overlap.
Sure. Yeah. Well, especially if someone worries when they're depressed, which, you know, that which can certainly be a part of that. So then worrying would be, could ignite the rest of the loop to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
and worrying, by the way, is the brain's kind of number one way of avoiding what's here. You know, it's another kind of right prefrontal shift type of activity. Unless we're kind of intentionally, if we're intentionally worrying, if we say, God, I have a lot of I have a lot to worry about. So this is where we bring mindfulness into this. I have a lot to worry about. I'm going to sit down, put down a piece of paper. I'm going to actively worry for 15 or 30 minutes. You might have done this or instructed people to do this in the past, where you're really kind of, it's more intentional, because mindfulness is intentionally paying attention to something with a sense of curiosity. So I'm saying I'm going to intentionally worry for 15 minutes. That way, what I'm practicing is a sense of personal control, which is the antithesis of feeling depressed or anxious. So I'm actively worrying. Now, if we're kind of worrying on and off throughout the day, what that's doing is that's the brain saying there's something uncomfortable here that I'm uncertain about or that I want to try and fix and problem solve. That gets us into this worrying place. And if worrying is part of that depressive loop, it's also going to start igniting other parts of it, other feelings, sensations, and behaviors that's going to kind of spiral us into this place. And as I say in Uncovering Happiness, I say, you know, contrary to the brain's belief, life itself is not a problem to be solved. It's a constantly evolving experience to be lived. And so the brain is always trying to solve our experiences. And in doing that, it oftentimes kind of ignites more of that avoidant type of reactivity in the brain, which is associated with depression.
Yeah, yeah. Somewhere along the way, I learned for myself to recognize when I'm caught in that kind of a loop and to realize it and to just kind of say, stop. And that's been pretty effective for me.
There you go. One of my favorite practices.
So. Yeah, yeah. So is this book just for those who are suffering from depression, or is it also for psychotherapists who would be treating depression?
Oh, absolutely. This, I mean, anybody who knows my work in some ways knows that what's most important to me, I made this decision a very long time ago. I made this decision actually when I went to that retreat a long time ago, when I challenged everything and I wasn't going to do anything. I made a decision not to really do anything in life unless it made sense to me, unless it had meaning to me, unless there was some kind of practical value that I understood. And so I think that's why, you know, as I moved into this, you know, years ago, as I moved into this kind of second phase of life or third phase of life or wherever I'm at, and I started becoming a psychologist and doing this type of work, I wanted to make everything simple and practical and meaningful in our everyday lives. So anything, a lot of the stuff that I write is saying, okay, so what's the science of this? What's the practical implications in our everyday life? In other words, how do we make happiness? And we can again get back to the definition of that. But how do we get a more enduring sense of kind of a meaningful well-being? How do we do that in our daily life? How do we make that come alive in our daily life? Basically, kind of the how of happiness. How do we make that real in our daily life? So in this, I give some of the science behind it, which is very practical to any healthcare professional, as well as people who are not healthcare professionals, and also practices that start to ignite these natural antidepressants, start to nurture them, that anyone can use to work with their clients, and be able to kind of do that together, kind of collaborate with that together. So
yeah, you have a lot of good exercises and practices, and I could even see, if you didn't mind, I could see a therapist actually maybe making handouts from some of the pages and giving them to people as, okay, here's something to do this coming week, and come back and we'll talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, do you mind if I mention like one of my favorite practices from the book?
I would love it if you would.
Okay. one of the things that happens that, you know, many of your listeners may or may not have heard of, but the brain has this kind of tendency towards paying attention to what's negative in life. And, you know, Rick Hansen does a beautiful job at talking about some of the research and science behind the negativity bias, and I explore it also within Uncovering Happiness. But the, you know, of course we, our brain is biased towards kind of paying attention to what's negative, because ultimately we're wired to survive and kind of populate to some degree versus be happy. And, cause you can be happy and dead and you won't pass on your genes. And so, you know, we want to,
yes,
that's kind of the way we're wired. So our brain's going to pay more attention. Negative stuff's going to be a little stickier than positive stuff. But I make this claim right now that I feel like we're in the middle of kind of an evolutionary period, within the human race. And it starts off with a small group of people and then it kind of expands. But where we're starting to understand how our brain works a little better, why it has this negative kind of bias in some way, and why it's important to then open it up a little bit more and nurture some of the good that's there in order to create a bit more of balance that's there. And that's why I think self-compassion is so powerful for that, because you're inclining to support yourself instead of be self-critical. And so you're starting even because of the pain, you're nurturing a greater sense of resiliency. It's almost like you need the pain in order to nurture this resiliency. Jalaluddin Rumi said, don't turn your gaze away. Look towards the bandaged place. That's where the light enters. So one of the things that we know is that our negative thoughts are really powerful, and we oftentimes identify with them, especially when we're kind of caught in that loop. I'm no good. Life is, I'll never amount to anything. Today is just going to be crappy all day long, or, you know, any number of negative thoughts, that's there. So, I love Byron Katie's four questions, where she asks these four questions, which I think help kind of give us a little space, help us become a little bit more mindful of our thoughts to some degree. And these questions kind of go like this. And I'll say this exercise, which I think is a really wonderful one that I've adapted from her work. And then I'll tell you the exercise that's about encouraging kind of more positive thoughts and confidence. So the first exercise goes like this. It's just four simple questions, which is, you have a negative thought, such as life is never going to, I'm not good enough. How about that one? That's a pretty common one. I'm not good enough. So you ask yourself the question, okay, so is that true? And usually for someone who's pretty identified with the thought, the answer is yes. I'm not good enough. Then you ask yourself a question to kind of further give you a little space, which is that absolutely true? Is this thought, I'm not good enough, absolutely true? Can I say with 100% certainty in all the areas of my life that this is absolutely true? And usually that cracks open a little window that says, well, okay, it's not absolutely true, not 100% true. I can't say that with 100% certainty. And you say, okay, so that gives you a little bit more objectivity on the thought for a moment, a little bit more space. And then you say, how does that thought make you feel? Again, you're saying, let's start to tease out the depressive loop a little bit. How does that thought make you feel? What feeling is associated with that thought? And you say, well, it makes me feel down, makes me feel, or anxious. It makes me feel, you know, heavy. It makes me feel these different ways. And you might say to yourself then, so what would be here if that thought wasn't here? So if that thought wasn't here, how would I feel? What would be here? You're again further objectifying the thought, getting more space from it. And a lot of people who answer that question say, well, I'd feel lighter. I'd feel, I don't know, there'd be more contentment. There'd be a greater sense of ease with me. I'd feel more confident. I'd have more motivation. So what we're trying to do is work on objectifying the thought and getting some space from it, getting some freedom from it. So those are those four questions. So then I say, okay, so how do you encourage positive thoughts then? So you're starting to, that helps you kind of tease out, get a little, disidentify a little bit more from the kind of negative thoughts, mind traps. So how do you do the positive thoughts?
Yeah.
How do you encourage this? So I say, this is something that encourages positive neuroplasticity, positive brain change. And so the neurons that will, these neurons will fire together, wire together, and create a little bit more resiliency. So you say, okay, well, think back into a time that was, and this is a wonderful exercise for any therapist or healthcare professional to work with their clients. Think back to a time when it was a good moment. Something was going well. Maybe it was a sunny day and you were feeling relaxed, or maybe you got really good feedback at work and you were feeling confident, or maybe you were with your kids and you were playing and there's a sense of ease that was there. Or, you know, maybe it was a morning where you're just sitting in bed drinking your coffee or tea and you're just feeling kind of calm. So then you say, well, what were you thinking during that time about yourself? And, you know, thoughts may come up like, I am good enough. Life is good as it is. You know, things are okay. You know, any number of these kind of more positive thoughts about yourself that do actually enter your mind at some points off and on in our lives. Maybe the negative can be a little bit more often, but these absolutely enter our mind. So then we ask ourselves, okay, is this thought, I'm good enough? This is an example. Is that true? And then what oftentimes is a quick snap comes and says, no, that's not true. So that's what often comes up, especially with someone who's suffered depression off and on throughout their life. Then you say, is it possible that it's true? Is there any possibility that I'm good enough is true anywhere in my life? Uh-huh. Is it possible? And the person often says, well, I guess it's a possibility that it's true. So you see, I'm playing on this. It's opening that window a little bit. And then you say, well, yeah. Okay, if you step into that possibility, how does that make you feel? What feeling is associated with that possibility? And two things happen here from my experience in doing this with many, many, many people, including myself. One is a resistance might come up because there's a fear of stepping into that possibility, because if I believe that this is true and then I get caught off guard, then the bigger they are, the harder they fall. And so there's a resistance that comes, meaning like, I don't want to believe this. I don't want to step into the light here, you know, in this way. And so then we can add some self-compassion. Yeah. This is a difficult moment in life. There's difficult moments. You know, how can I be kind to myself around this resistance right now? And for other people, and so we can massage that. For other people, they step into it and there's a sense of expansion. There's a sense of lightness. There's a sense of contentment, joy that arises from that. So we start recognizing that feeling. And here's where the positive neuroplasticity comes in. The next question, the final question is, can you allow yourself to linger in that for a few more moments? Because neurons that fire together wire together. So we're lingering in this space of possibility, this space of emotion that's associated with this positive thought that is possible. And so we're allowing ourselves to kind of linger in that and linger into that in that moment. And for a lot of people, these four questions really do open up, crack open a sense of possibility that opens them up to seeing things differently in their life. And so you can do that both ways, working with negative thoughts or working with positive thoughts, to encourage space from negative thoughts or to encourage more of a connection to a sense of lingering into that positive thought.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you shared those two exercises with us. And it really reveals a kind of a micro way that you kind of tease out, as you say, these different thoughts that can so subtly and so quickly and usually even unconsciously flit through our mind, this kind of negative loop that you talk about. And you're kind of breaking it down as you suggest, you're kind of creating a little bit of space both from the negative and towards the positive. And your book is really chock full of that kind of processing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all stuff that I've found to be helpful towards myself or the people I've worked with, or stuff that makes sense according to the science that's there too, to start to kind of push those neurons to fire in a more balanced way, that create that towards that sense of more of a resilient brain.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that you advise is that people reverse bad habits. And of course, here we are in January, the time of New Year's resolutions that often are broken. What sorts of bad habits do you have in mind? And do you have specific advice or techniques that would help a person break those bad habits?
So this is great. I've been teaching, you know, well before I even wrote this book, or actually inspired by the beginnings of it, which it's taken me, you know, this book's a combination of like 3 years of writing the book, but you know, a decade of my own research and working with people in it. And what I found is breaking bad habits is really attractive to all of us. That comes from when we talk about this depressive loop, two of those parts of that loop are thinking and behaving. Most of the time when we think of bad habits, we think of our behaviors, like I'm not exercising enough, I'm procrastinating, I stress eat, you know, all these things we want to break, these behaviors. But the number one bad habit that may surprise a lot of us is thinking. Because before we get involved with any of those behavioral bad habits, our mental bad habits have to kind of kick in. I use the word bad, even though we're trying to be kind of like non-judgmental in some way. Bad is like, you know, the kind of destructive to us in some way, not working in our favor, I guess. And the thoughts that come are thoughts that are like the self-judgmental thoughts or the mind traps that are there that are doubting we can do something or always wanting more of something. Something's never good enough. So I always need kind of more of something. These types of thoughts we need to kind of learn to get space from. And so that's what you and I had just talked about. So that's one bad habit. The next bad habit being the behavioral ones, which is the ones we mostly associate ourselves with. One way of working with kind of shifting out our bad habits, which again, the thinking and the behaving both work to fuel the depression loop. If we change some of our behavioral bad habits, that can really make a strong impact on the depression loop that's there and also create a sense of resiliency. So that's why the very second section of Uncovering Happiness is all around kind of like breaking these bad habits that are there to help as a foundation to cultivating, to uncovering happiness. And so with the behavioral ones, I oftentimes think of it and say, if my habit is stress eating, for example, which is a big one for a lot of us, and I have to kind of explore that and say, you know, what is it about this stress eating that I'm getting out of this? Like, in other words, not as a rhetorical thing of saying, well, I'm not getting anything out of it. It's a terrible thing for me. But more as a real question, an intentional question to be curious about. That's that moment of mindfulness, to be curiously engaged with something. And to say, what is it? And so for a lot of people, they might say, well, I feel a sense of ease. I get stressed, so I feel a sense of ease. It gives me a sense of relief. Or for other people, they might say, well, I do it because when I dig down, it's kind of like I really just want to be connecting with people. I know Charles Duhigg in The Power of Habit talks about this experience of his where he's eating cookies all day or during at lunchtime or whatever. I don't remember what time of day it was, but really when he kind of dug down, he realized it was what he really wanted to do was just be connecting with his friends. And once he did that, he didn't have the craving for the cookie anymore. And so, so we have to look at what is underneath this. What am I really craving underneath? It's not the cookie so much. Is there something that I'm craving? Some sense of relief, some sense of ease, some sense of loving myself, some sense of connection with other people. And when we get curious about that and look at it, we can then ask ourselves the question, okay, is there another way that I can get this? Is there another way that I can get ease, relief, connection, you know, these types of things? Is there another way that I can get this? And we can explore a variety of possibilities of doing that. So, for example, I was working with a woman who had a habit of going by a bakery every day, and every day she would buy a cake and she would eat the cake. And so, you know, she's obviously overweight. And the first step is never to tell someone, okay, so now that you know, for her, it was really kind of a relief from her stress that was there. She was really seeking kind of more ease. It was kind of filling her sense of insecurity as well. Like, she didn't have to deal with that as much. And it's not to tell someone, okay, so now that you know what it is, go ahead and do it. Go get the connection. Go find the ease. Here's some practices to play with and go do this and let's see how you are with it. That's not ultimately very successful because in the moment when you're in the midst of the bad habit, you've kind of lost blood flow to your prefrontal cortex in some ways, and you're being controlled more by your amygdala or your emotional brain. And so you're not really totally in control. Dopamine is pushing in your brain. That's the motivational chemical. You don't have the impulse control that's there. And so it's not a real fair fight. And so what we want to do first is visualize. Visualization is a powerful technique to work with people and in our own lives. I mean, we know that visualizing can change the brain in the same way that actually doing an activity can do. That was a study at a Harvard playing piano. I don't know if you remember that one, Dave, that...
Yeah, I think I do. The sense that the brain doesn't really know the difference between what's outside and inside in a certain kind of way.
Yeah, so that was the idea.
Go ahead and tell us the study.
That was the idea of the They brought students in to play a piano score over time for 5 days a week, I think for an hour at a time or something like that. And they measured their brain activity, and what they showed that they show growth in their motor cortex, the part of the brain that is active when we're moving our bodies. And they took another group in, and so that's some neuroplasticity. That's interesting. And they took another group in, and they had them just visualize, imagine playing that score for the same amount of time, and they showed the same activity and growth in their motor cortex. So visualization is powerful. We see it in sports. We see it in corporate culture. We see it everywhere to kind of improve upon certain, certain even kind of skill sets, even if it's just physical skill set. So with this, what we want to do is we want to uncover what the real need is for somebody. Then we want to have them visualize engaging with that habit, whatever it is. Let's say in this case, it's eating. And then let's say it's to find relief and ease in some way. And someone says, well, actually taking a walk would provide me with that space, that relief, that ease. And so, or calling my friend would do that. And so what we do is we have them visualize that stressful experience in the midst of being with the food that's there, not engaging with the food, and then choosing to do the other activity, whatever it is, and noticing the experience of that. And as they practice and repeat this visualization, they'll find that it gets easier and easier to do. And what's happening is you're creating some kind of memory inside your mind, conditioning together the moment of wanting to be with the food or whatever it is, and then choosing to do this other activity. That makes it just far more likely. You give yourself a much better chance of now that happening in your regular life, because now you've created a memory of it. And memories are what mediate our brain's automatic decision making. So if it's your brain is reaching back into its history in the moment that there's food there, and it's weighing in what your memories are telling you to do, and it catches a memory there that says, oh, I have this other option. What may come to mind, what you may notice comes to mind in your real life is, oh, I can choose to do this instead, because I know what I'm really needing is relief in this, and this just kind of doesn't lead to where I want it to go, and you're more likely to actually choose that. And so that's a form of therapy called kind of habit reversal therapy that that we can use. But the visualization part
is there any quote scientific evidence to support that?
There is science behind it. You don't want to use habit reversal to just change depression. There's no real science behind that, but it works with the habits, which I think can change the depression loop.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You talk about five natural antidepressants in the brain. And so we know that there's a lot of concern about the abuse of antidepressants that come in the form of pills and so on. So maybe you can take us through the five natural antidepressants, and I'm sure you have been already to some extent, but just to kind of call them out for us.
Okay, absolutely. I think the last thing I want to just tag on to that last piece is that, just to make this kind of easier for people as far as the habits are concerned, is that it's important. Good. The mindset you want to bring to this is kind of in a mindset of experimentation. In other words, you don't want to have like the mindset of, I'm going to try this out, and if it doesn't work, I failed. And look, nothing's helping me. I can't help myself, just encouraging kind of that depression loop. Instead, you want to bring kind of that more mindful attitude of curiosity, or that learning mindset of saying, I'm going to try something. And in life, there's obstacles. Obstacles are inevitable in life. So I might try this visualization and it may not work the first time. Or I might try it and it may work the first time. But what I want to do is this practice that I've adapted from mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is called forgive and invite. But I call it forgive, investigate, and invite. Which is when you fall off the path of doing this kind of work of breaking your bad habits or what anything that we're talking about today, that's a moment of just noticing. The moment you notice that is the moment you're waking up. And what you want to do is then investigate. So that's a moment of congratulation versus self-criticism or self-loathing. What you want to do is investigate now how did I get here? What brought me off track? Because that's the only way we're going to now learn and grow from this. That gives us kind of that leap up, is to investigate what brought us off track. What were the obstacles that were here? Was it certain mindsets, or did I just lose sight of thing, or was there stress that came up in my life that led me to this? Is there certain people in my life that I associate with that kind of lend, I tend to lend more towards these kind of bad habits? So I investigate that and I say, okay, so now that I've kind of learned from that, now in this present moment, I can invite myself to begin again. That's how real change happens. If there's any secret to change, that's really it, is to practice forgive, investigate, and invite. So we can learn from the obstacles and the waywardness that's inevitable in our life and bring it back and incorporate it now as I kind of move forward again. And so there's a little piece to that breaking bad habits piece, or to any of these natural antidepressants. That's the final, and so just segueing into these natural antidepressants, that's actually the final and maybe the underlying thread natural antidepressant that's there that's involved with mastery. You want to really master something. Mm-hmm. You engage this learning mindset, because that helps you get back in track to just get increasingly better and better at what you're doing. And that's how neuroplasticity kind of works, because we start engaging it more and more. So the more the neurons fire together more, they wire together more in that particular direction. So that's called a growth mindset. It helps us grow. That's a term that a woman from Stanford named Carol Dweck came up with. Versus a fixed mindset, which is oftentimes a mindset that hits us when we're feeling depressed, which is what I can and can't do. I'm unable to do anything outside this box. And the research has found that, at least some of the research by Carol Dweck has found that students that have this growth mindset, just students because she did it with undergraduate students, of course, who have this growth mindset, are more likely to be resilient in the midst of a depressive episode than the ones who do not. So underneath the growth mindset is this sense of being curious and treating everything as a learning experience. So that's one of the very key natural antidepressants, is this sense of having that learning mindset, which creates confidence and is more the direction towards mastery. So I'll let that be as a thread through there. Then the other core natural antidepressants that we're seeing in the science, as well as just in our lives and working with people, is mindfulness and self-compassion, which is what I mentioned before. Both of those create, well, we'll say this, mindfulness and compassion both have been shown to create a left prefrontal shift in the brain, which has been, again, more associated with approaching things in life and a sense of resiliency and positive emotions. Although self-compassion is a newer thing in the newer kind of, I don't want to say it's a newer term, but it's newer in the field of science, meaning it's just starting to be researched. And Kristen Neff's doing a lot of great work with it, among other people. But you know, when something's newer, it takes a little bit to get grant money, to get neuroscience studies, to get, you know, this type of stuff. So we don't have as much of the neuroscience behind that, but we do have some studies that we can kind of make a little leap and say, well, okay, this is what we're imagining may be happening. But ultimately, let me say this, Dave, ultimately science only is there to kind of confirm things we oftentimes already know. And so when I say, when I say self-compassion, this practice of kind of maybe putting my hand on my body, my chest or my stomach, this is a way of approaching myself. So I have to imagine that creates a left prefrontal shift. But one thing I do know is that when I put my hand on my body, when I'm suffering in some way, when I have a lot of thinking going on, my body has to map the sensation of my hand in order for me to feel it. So I'm lighting up certain parts of my brain that are inversely correlated with the part of my brain that's trying to analyze, figure out, and fix the issue that's here, which is oftentimes involved with worrying or rehashing past events or ruminating. So putting my hand on my body...
Just to highlight that, that's such a simple act of self-soothing, putting your hand on your body. I've heard that before, and I never think to do it. But just as you're saying it now, I'm putting my hand on my heart, on my chest, and I'm feeling something positive just in doing that very simple little act. But it's the remembering to do these things is the trick.
And when you do it like you're doing it right now, and if everyone who's listening kind of does this right now, you're creating a memory of it. which your brain is more likely, you're giving yourself, the more you do it, the more likely you are, your brain to reference it. So the more likely it is to actually come up. And I say at Uncovering Happiness, if all you do is put your hand on your heart and wish yourself well, your time will be well spent. Because, you know, it's a way of kind of being kind to yourself. This is why this is a natural antidepressant. We know that in at least some of the science that's come out there, it has not the neuroscience, but some of the research that's come out there, we see that depression, I think, is, as I said before, is inversely correlated with self-compassion, meaning people who have struggled with depression over time have a very low sense of self-compassion. So if you raise self-compassion up, there's an inverse relationship. You're going to kind of bring the depressive tendencies down. And so we're kind of shoring up the skills of this kind of self-soothing technique in the midst of difficulty. So mindfulness and self-compassion together create a really wonderful healing effect for us in the midst of a depressive loop or just in life during difficult moments in general. Overwhelm or anything like that are two wonderful things to begin to put into practice. And then the other natural antidepressants, when I say mindfulness is not enough, we have the self-compassion piece and we have a sense of purpose. You go into any, and listeners may or may not identify with this, but you go into any AA or NA meeting, oftentimes people who have addictive tendency also struggle with comorbid depression or anxiety, these different things. I mean, how can you not? You're abusing your body like I was, your mind and body. And so you naturally are sending yourself the message, I'm not worth taking care of, which is a kind of pretty depressive message. And so the first thing that they say in any of those groups is go out and do something, go volunteer somewhere, get out there, is get out and connect with a cause that's greater than your own. And depression is such a self-loathing type of experience, and even anxiety is, and even when we're feeling overwhelmed with life, it's all about us. Our mind is spinning about our lives, what's wrong with us, how can we fix us, our family, our. And so what we need to do is balance that by getting involved with a cause greater than our own, something that gives us a sense of connection with something greater than ourselves. That's kind of the essence of purpose. And so in the book, I bring people through kind of ways to start to uncover different things in their life that they may connect with that give them a sense of purpose. So compassion and purpose, to me, go hand in hand. Compassion is recognizing someone else's suffering with this inclination to want to support them. And so as we do that, we know that creates that left prefrontal shift that calms the amygdala. We've seen that in the studies. And it just feels good because we feel more connected. We know connection, feeling connected, makes us feel balanced. When we feel balanced, we feel happy. We feel disconnected, we feel imbalanced, we feel unhappy. So we're moving towards connection as a path of as being a natural antidepressant. The other thing to kind of...
Go ahead.
You were going to say, is there any way?
I was going to ask if there's an example that comes to mind, maybe a case example of helping someone connect to purpose that was having difficulty doing that.
So I do this with lots of my clients that I see, which is, so one client I had, and I'll give you a case example that kind of does both of these things, which is the other antidepressant is play. Another one is play, that idea of getting involved maybe with a more purposeless activity that's there, but something that's engaging, something that creates novelty, something where there's a sense of freedom to it. Fun. So as adults, we lose that sense of things. And so both purpose and play are engaging. It's the opposite of when we're feeling depressed. And so here was a client who was also very wayward, had a history of kind of abusing her body with different barbiturates and sedatives and things like that, and like Vicodin. And she came to me and was really, really lost. And I asked her to reach back, and this is just a trick to do as far as igniting a little play, reach back into her childhood. And I asked her, well, what was playful to you then? And she remembered going to these ranches and helping take care of these horses and riding on the horses at times. And I asked her, when's the last time she did anything like that? And she said, you know, it's just been a really long time, probably since then. And she said she did know someone in the area that had a ranch, and I had her. I just kind of took a leap of faith as a therapist, and I had her call that person right then and there. And this is a story in the book where she called the person, and she got connected with her, and over time started developing a relationship and going there and assisting in being there and helping. And so this woman did equine therapy, which is using horses as kind of a mediation towards kind of helping people heal. It's a whole different interview entirely. And
sure.
She felt some sense of connection and purpose in that she was helping other people. This woman went on to go back to school, to become a therapist, to become an equine, to go into equine-assisted psychotherapy, and she's engaging in this now. She went and got involved in a mindfulness meditation center where she felt a greater sense of connection and purpose there too. But I just received an email from her recently just saying how well she's actually doing and how this life that she never thought that she'd have. And so it was clearly a natural antidepressant. So for her, being with the horses was a sense of play because it was very connecting, engaging, and it brought a lightness to her. And then there was the purpose of actually doing her work in that direction too. And there's a whole slew of examples like that, and just to kind of start to ignite people's ideas in that. And oftentimes when we talk of purpose, when we've had depression in the past, our mind often goes to what we can't do in life. Well, I can't do that. I can't do this. Well, yeah, go volunteer at a charity. I can't do that. So what we want to do is, because that's just the way our mind works, want to do is ask ourselves the question, not what can't I do, but what can I do? Try and incline towards that direction. We know mm-hmm. all the mind's going to say, what can't I do? Mm-hmm. So ask yourself, what can I do instead of what can't I do? This is also a wonderful technique that any therapist or anybody on the line who's not a therapist can use with themselves. What can I do instead of what can't I do?
Boy, all I have to do is open the gate and let your horse out and run. And we just get a ton of great information here. I'm thinking we've reached the point where probably we should begin to wind down. I mean, there's so much more in your book that we could cover. But what would you like to say as kind of to wrap things up here?
I would say that what I've found here is a very practical and strong story of hope. This is when we often think of the word antidepressant, we think of a pill, which is fine and can be very supportive to a lot of people. But that's not the only kind of antidepressant. We now know, and we're finding that we have these natural antidepressants within us that when we intentionally practice and repeat and bring into our lives, actually create the neural change that I would say not only really does create an antidepressant brain, but more so than that, uncovers a deeper and more enduring core happiness that's there and for the taking within each and every one of us.
Well, that's a wonderful close. Dr. Elisha Goldstein, I want to thank you again for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yeah, really a pleasure. Wonderful to be here with you.
Well, it's always a delight to talk with Elisha. I had prepared a lot of questions for him, but he covered most of the ground without me ever getting to them. I think from what he said, you can begin to get a sense of the depth and range of his book and the thought that he's put into it. In fact, his book is chock full of practical advice and concrete exercises, which would be useful both to lay people suffering from depression and the psychotherapists who work with them. And in some ways, this is a kind of workbook. There's enough there to keep a person very busy for a long time. I mean, he even has 3 antidepressant yoga poses. I especially liked his formula for breaking up the depression loop, which, if I recall correctly, was forgive, investigate, invite. Implied in that, I think, was a first step of notice, which I guess is the mindful part. Also, it was good for me to be reminded of the self-soothing technique of simply placing my hand on my heart. So simple, so powerful, and all too easy to forget in the rush of things. This would be an excellent book for you to own or to give as a gift. Remember, you can use the Amazon.com widget in our right-hand sidebar to order Uncovering Happiness by Dr. Elisha Goldstein.
David, Amy Feldman calling here from Melbourne, Australia. I'm calling to let you know that I've just made my first donation to Shrink Wrap Radio after being a committed listener now for about 18 months. I admit I've thought about donating many times. I was inspired to donate tonight after listening to your interview with Dr. Jeff Magnavita. I listened right to the end and I've noticed that lately I'm listening to your whole outro, so including all of your personal reflections, your calls to action, and your sharing of other people's voicemails and emails, etc. So, yeah, I'll admit I used to probably stop at your personal reflections. So I noticed this change and I thought about it and I realised that I think it's because I'm starting to feel like I know you on a personal level from having listened to so many shows. Well, not only did I want to show you my gratitude for your show by donating, but I thought it was worth sharing that. And I think it really reflects your personal style of interviewing, because I often feel like I'm sitting in the lounge room with the two of you and I'm quite often tempted to chime in myself. Also, in your last interview, one of Dr. Jeff Magnavita's words of advice for new clinicians was to kind of be aware of that temptation to kind of grab onto and define oneself by a specific therapeutic kind of framework early on. And he really suggested practice staying open-minded and interested in many ways of working. I've been working as a psychologist now for about 4 months in a specialised therapeutic setting practising DBT. So this was really relevant to me. So while I'm, you know, fully immersed in my work, listening to Shrink Wrap is definitely one of the ways that I'm able to do this. It definitely keeps me feeling informed, engaged, and really motivated and inspired to keep learning and challenging myself. So, Dr. Dave, thank you so much for this awesome podcast and for your generosity. And it's true, it feels really good to donate. So thanks again, and I'll keep listening. Bye.
Thank you, Amy Feldman, there down under. It's always good to hear from another psychologist. And all those of you who are not Amy Feldman, if you aren't already on the donor honor roll on our website, how about making that commitment and getting your name up there right away for the whole Shrink Wrap Radio community to see and to derive inspiration from your action? Let me take a moment to announce recent additions to our donor honor roll. My thanks go out to Richard and Linda Brovard, Luke McMahon, Gwen Smith, Donna Raymond, Bradley Manning, Vicky Dunn, and Natasha LeBrock. And if I made any mistakes in pronunciation, I hereby apologize. I'm happy to announce that we have a new transcript on the site. It's number 436, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma, with Bessel van der Kolk, M.D. Thanks to listener and acupuncturist Selma Mitchell for transcribing that one. It's a very important one, I think. It's been a while since I mentioned our affiliate, Ed4 Online. That's spelled ED, the numeral 4, and online. And what I've mentioned previously is that you can earn a continuing education unit through some of the 20 Shrink Wrap Radio interviews that are on their site. What I haven't told you is that they specialize in online vocational training for a wide number of careers. Here's what they say on their website, quote, "Start training today. Shrink Wrap Radio, together with Ed4 Online, can help you start training for a new career or get training to advance in your current career. We offer online, self-paced, open enrollment programs to help you gain the high-demand skills needed in today's workplace. Our courses are available anytime, anywhere, from any mobile device, as long as you have access to the internet. The courses are self-paced and incorporate a variety of learning methods to support you on your educational journey. Whether you're looking to start a new career or advance in your current occupation, our online training courses are designed to provide you with the skills needed to be successful in your chosen profession, end quote. Because of our affiliate relationship, any online course you take through them will result in a donation to Shrink Wrap Radio, not just the ones based on the interviews I did, but their whole course catalog, which is quite extensive. So just click on the Ed4 online banner ad in the left-hand sidebar on our site, or you can go directly to shrinkwrapradio.ed4online.com. And Ed4 is simply ED, the numeral 4, and online, all as one word. I hope you're subscribing to our free monthly newsletter. There's a sign-up form at the very top of the left-hand sidebar on our site. I mention this now because I'm happy to announce a new feature that will appear in the very next newsletter, which will be a regular blog posting by our new Shrink Wrap Radio resident blogger, Dr. Mariana Naldi. Maybe it's Mariana. Mariana. I'll try to get that clarified. You'll want to be sure to check on her introductory post in our February issue of the newsletter. Finally, let me remind those of you who might be new to the show that there is an app for that. Namely, we have an app for both iOS and Android devices that will make it easy for you to stay up to date in your listening to Shrink Wrap Radio on your mobile device. It lets you stream the most recent 80 or so shows to your mobile device. We're paying $20 a month just so that you can have access to this service. So by all means, take advantage of it. Just go to the Apps tab on the Shrink Wrap Radio site.
Yeah, you should really listen to that Dr. Dave show. A lot of people are tuning in. It's extremely popular. I've met Dr. Dave a couple times and listened to his show and liked it very much. There's a lot of good stuff there. And for those of you who are into what your mind is doing, it's an interesting little piece of your body. What's going on in your head? You might want to check it out. Shrink Wrap Radio, shrinkwrapradio.com.
Thank you, Adam Curry, one of the very first, if not the first, podcaster, and the person who did start the first podcast network, which I was a part of in my own early years of podcasting. And he also was the person who persuaded Steve Jobs to add a podcast category to the iTunes subscriptions, which gave podcasting an enormous boost. I just saw a factoid that there are now something like 41 million listeners to podcasts. Hey, I'd be satisfied with a few hundred thousand of those. If only. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. This one is not an email, but an actual physical note I received in the U.S. Post, along with a check to help support the show. And it's from Crystal in Seattle, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, love your show. I just listened to the interview with Dr. Paul Swingle for the second time. What a great interview. I hope you will get Saberne Fisher on your show as well. Her book, which just came out in April 2014, is wonderful." And the title of that book, by the way, I had to look it up because I didn't know her name, but the title of that book is Neurofeedback in the Treatment of Developmental Trauma, Calming the Fear-Driven Brain. Well, that's definitely in my wheelhouse, and I think that it will be an author that I will go after. Crystal ends, "Thanks for all your hard work," and that's from Crystal in Seattle. So, Crystal, thanks so much for that recommendation. Thanks for your check of support, by the way, and for your enthusiasm and for this excellent suggestion. And with that, I think we will wrap it up once again. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone, please, 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 it's been so long, at 415-830-4014. Thanks to return guest Dr. Elisha Goldstein for sharing his approach to the relief of depression using such tools as mindfulness and self-compassion. My next interview will be with counselor, coach, and author Molly Young Brown, and we'll be discussing psychosynthesis, past, present, and future. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.